Okay. Welcome. Thanks for being here. Week 7. You've seen this before. We're going to have a doubleheader worth of speakers today, so hang on. I have, one item for our celebration on March 11th, the last day of class after your presentations. We're going to have some food, and I'm going to pass around menus of a couple catering services, so I'd like to maybe try to get a consensus on what people like. Otherwise, you're going to get what I like, and that may not be the most popular. So you can make a note and email me mark on the sheet, which one you like. That'll be good. And want to remind people to get in touch with me. The people who are doing projects, get in touch with me on a weekly basis so I can make sure that, you're making progress, and to help you along and to provide expertise and direction and contacts and things like that. So I've been putting as much stuff as I can on the website, and already the slides and the handouts for this class are already on there, and the audio will be up tonight in case you want to review or if you missed the class. But I can't. People who are here aren't going to miss the class. Next week, we're going to have a special guest. Peter Axelson is a colleague of mine, was a colleague of mine at the VA, and he's a Stanford alumnus, and he lives in Nevada, and he's going to be flying his plane in, which may not be as remarkable as is actually more remarkable than you might think, because he's a wheelchair user and he has an adapted plane, and he'll be talking a little bit about that. But he's also an engineer, and he has a company, and so he's going to be talking about all the things that he's done and how he's done them. So that's going to be really special. Any questions at all so far? Or does everybody know it all? Okay. Well, batting first is Doug Schwant. And I've known Doug for about 25 years or longer. And he came to Stanford as a mechanical engineering student, graduate a mechanical engineering student. He worked in on a 210 student team to create the first arm-powered two-wheeled bicycle for people with lower limb disabilities, and it was called the hand bike. And he has a picture of that. And after graduation, he worked with me at the Rehab R&D Center, working on other rehab devices, including some more development of the hand bike. He worked on me with a finger-spelling hand. He worked on a hypergravity device specialized ergometers. And over the years, Doug has consulted on various exciting and challenging projects outside the VA, including exercise concepts for long-term space travel. Some of his devices that have actually been on the shuttle. He's worked on MRI-compatible fixtures and mobility devices and robotics for physical therapy. Although he isn't a VA employee, Doug continues to work with universities and companies as a freelance consulting design engineer and part-time as a springboard diving coach. And I should mention that he is going to be coaching in that capacity, and he's going to have to leave early. So we'll all apologize. No, we'll all let Doug go when he needs to. Okay, Doug, come on up. Put this on.
I recognize a lot of people in the audience, so I think it's hopefully a friendly crowd.
Okay.
Oh, thanks. So Dave asked me to describe two or three of my projects and to maybe help with some suggestions for how I approach and how you might consider approaching your projects here in this class, and then if you continue on in design. You can kind of keep some of these ideas as guidelines if you like. There are things that people have shared with me over the years and I use over and over again. So let's see here. So I'm going to start with just a brief list of things that I use as a guideline through to kind of guide the process of a design project, and then show three or four of the projects that I've worked on. And then there's some kind of fun quotes that I've added from people that I've worked with, particularly a machinist that some of us know that was at the VA with me. So to start with, this list was given to us when I was a ME210, which is now 310, when I was a student here working on the hand bike project. And you memorize it as you use it, but has anybody in this group worked on a design project and actually seen a list like this of the steps you might go through?
Is it Eric?
Yeah. And everybody in the class is working on a project, right?
Not everybody.
They can choose. You can choose to or whatever.
Some people are from the community.
Oh, of course, yeah. Okay, so basically you need to start out with a need. Otherwise, you might as well not be working on the project. And there's two ways of looking at it. And as an engineer or a designer, the way that we prefer to look at it is we have an idea and we go out and look for some place where the need could be, where it could resolve a need. And you listen to other people talk who aren't engineers and they say, don't do that, get the need, and then find the technology. But I think it doesn't really matter too much if you're someone with a disability, and it doesn't really matter how the need was established, whether it came from someone that just had a cute technical idea or whether it was because someone expressed the need. So just be sure to establish the need. And what I do with this list is you can enter at any point and work on it and jump forward and backwards on the list in time. The next item on the list is the state of the art. And I've seen a number of projects, especially students that would come and visit us at the VA with an idea, and they would already be working away on something that had been done 10 years before. And it doesn't mean it means that it's a good idea, typically, if it's been worked on. But it's good not to just repeat something, add something new to the process, to the art. The part that I think is the most fun typically is where you get to imagine the ideas, the concept. What are you trying to do and how might you do it? Typically sketches, back of the envelope, whiteboards, modeling. As Dave Kelly has talked about, it's basically just get right in and do it. I forget, who's taken Dave Kelly's classes? Do you know who he is? Some of us do. He started the IDEO company as a student. It was initially called Dave Kelly Design. It's now the premier design company in the world. And he suggests just roll up your sleeves, just get right in and start building models. Let's see. So then the rest of these are probably pretty straightforward. You've got to choose one. That's to select the preferred concept. You do the analysis and the detailed drawings. Do some tests, make sure that it's going to work. Start making something, early models and prototypes that you can actually use. Do the testing. It's pretty obvious. The hardest part, I think, is at the end, and we struggled with that. Dave has probably talked about the technology transfer. Maury, who's here, has also been heavily involved in tech transfer. It's really hard to get a product out because of all of the impediments. So let me just go over two or three of the projects. This is the hand bike that Dave referred to. And you'll probably see this again next week because Peter Axelson, who's flying in with hand controls, was the inspiration and the team leader and his idea to get this bicycle going when I was a student. And we've worked together and stayed in contact over the years. It was all because of him coming in saying, I want this device. And in that case, it was someone with a disability and a need. It wasn't just someone had figured out a way to do arm-powered bicycling. So the hand bike is essentially as the name suggests, arm-powered, hand-powered bicycle. You balance on two wheels, which is the kind of novel feature of it. You can balance and steer, and side wheels can be set down to make it stable when you come to a stop. I was going to ask if anybody in here can imagine what would be the problem with a bicycle with arm power. What's your first concern if you can't put your legs down? You're going to fall over. What would you do, aside from looking at this, and it doesn't really show what we did first to get past that, what would you think of to do if you want to do an arm-powered bicycle and no one's letting you do it because it looks too dangerous, you're going to fall over? How would you do it?
Make a trike,
yeah. Definitely the tricycle is... We had one faculty advisor who quit the project because he thought two-wheeling was too dangerous and too difficult to do. And he suggested do a trike. Now, you still want to do the bike. How do you get... Yeah.
Gyro stabilization.
Gyro. That's great. Exactly. definitely gyro. Because you don't want the thing to tip over when you come to a stop. What's another thing that you could do? Believe me, we went for months, and one guy finally suggested this. Professor Leifer suggested how we got over our threshold of... What else could you do? Can you think of it? Any hints? Ingrid, do you know the answer? What helped us through the rough spot was Professor Leifer suggested that we make the bike low enough to the ground that you can put your hands down when you come to a stop. So we had these skateboard gloves on, and we had fixed roller skate wheels, and you put your hands on the ground. In fact, I think the next slide shows. Yeah, that. Let's see if I can find this. This is Peter Axelson, who will be here next week, and Candy Mintz, who was my partner. This is me, and this is Peter Johnson, who's still a builder in the area. And that was our first prototype, and that's how we got the project started. These just show some of the other later versions of it. Starting with foam core, starting with cutting up an old bike, getting to this point, thinking we need to race it, trying it out with different individuals to give us some feedback. And then while we were playing on this, we thought we might as well do a tandem. And this picture shows one of the bike builders in Oregon that I worked with on our first tandem bike. And you notice that this tandem is essentially a hand bike with an upright back end stuck on it. And we would ride this around. It had steering in the back and steering in the front. And shortly after this was finished, I've been dragged into an antique store where I don't really enjoy going, but they had a bike just like this from 1896 because they thought that men would sit in the back and they had to help women steer. Something like that. This bike led to this one because my cousin and I were riding around on this one just on the bike trails, and we thought, well, we want foot power in the front and it would work for someone with a disability. So I would ask you, do you think that this is me, and I'm not very disabled. Just in when I'm speaking. But the woman in the front, do you think that she would have a disability? Can you imagine a disability?
She doesn't look disabled.
She doesn't look disabled. She has MS, yeah, multiple sclerosis, and hadn't been on a bike in years, but was able to, just even with one hand crank, to help her legs through the weak part of the stroke. I'm just going to move on to another project. Unless anybody has questions about the bikes.
Maybe we can get Doug to bring the bike on March 11th.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I have one of these hand bikes that I play with, and I can bring it in for you to try if you want. This was another project, and I'm showing these because they're fun projects for me, and I was thinking I might inspire some people who have some interest in design to find fun projects and make it a bit of a career for yourselves. The guy here in the blue is Scott Perzinski, and he He was the astronaut that was on the repair of the solar array. He's a doctor, and he went up there and did sutures to put everything back. He was way out there on the end of this robotic arm. And he was a medical student here at Stanford, and he came to several of us, Jim, the machinist here at the VA, and a couple other friends, and said, can you help us build exercise equipment for space travel? And that's basically how this project started. And we decided to do a device which was essentially working one part of your body against another. And
What are you in there?
Thanks, Dave. This is we were testing it on board NASA's Vomit Comet. Has anybody heard of the Vomit Comet? It simulates microgravity by doing parabolas out over the Gulf of Mexico.
Now you pay $3,500 for those
flights. You pay big time.
For a person.
And the fun thing about this was there wasn't a whole lot of data we had to collect. We just had to get in and out of it and try different exercises. So we scheduled very quick protocol, and we finished in half the parabolas, and we had something like 20 parabolas to play. And Scott, he hadn't become an astronaut yet, but he was dead set on it, and he did become one. He told us later they would go up all the time, and they could start at the back of the plane and push off the back of the plane and do Superman dives through the hole. So the design work and the need that it's is sort of secondary to the process for some of us that are designing. This is Jim Anderson, who did the machining. He did he made flight hardware. It had to be tested before it could go into space. And he had trained at NASA but had never done any flight hardware, so this was his dream project. I'll just show you this one other project. This is one that I have been working on in Chicago. It's a cart, essentially, that follows someone around, a robotic assist for physical therapy. And it involves all kinds of mechanisms, which is good for the students in here that I recognize from the dynamics class. Lots of moving parts. And it's for someone who's had a stroke or Parkinson's, typically for heavy people, so the physical therapist doesn't have to hold them up while they work with them. This was funded by a NIST grant. It was an idea of a professor of physical therapy, Dave Brown, and two design professors at Northwestern. They got funding, did the project. Now it's leading to other devices. Still not on the market, really. It's pretty expensive, but it will be. So any questions about this? I don't want to... Yeah. I think since I'm running short on time, I'll be happy to talk about some of the other projects later individually with people. This is on the website for this company, Kinea Design. I'll just tell you what it is. It's a sensing finger for someone who's lost their arm. So an artificial arm can actually, by having a sensing finger, can feel... The person that's using this artificial arm can feel because there's a little mechanism that sort of flicks at the skin right here, and the nerves that used to go to the finger are sitting right below the surface of the skin. So if you were to close your eyes and move your artificial arm, you could feel.
Is it done by electrical stimulation or just physical stimulation?
Physical stimulation. It's actually a little, they call it a tactor. It's a little mechanism that plunges and shears the skin.
Okay, this finally just kind of a little list of words of wisdom that I've heard over the years, mostly from this one machinist that you saw in the space flight hardware project, Jim Anderson, who's now retired and probably someone that you could look up if you wanted to get some help on any kind of detailed design. The first one is pretty obvious. Make sure that you stay in contact with who you're trying to, the person who has the need that you're trying to meet, and make sure that they're happy with what you're doing. I tend to use SolidWorks heavily. I like the idea of starting with things that I know, the parts of the assembly that I know are going to be there, and then it's just to me, it's like packing groceries that are essentially still moving and as tight as a watch. It tends to be really tight configurations of things. And SolidWorks is about the only way for me to accomplish some of them. Reviewing your notes, just keep your notes from your analytical classes and from design classes if you're going to do some work in design, and refer to them. Let's see. I think this don't bite off too much. It's basically don't bite off too much at a time because you want to have some confidence that you're going to finish what you're working on and don't feel like you're overwhelmed all the time. And then when you do feel overwhelmed, and I had to be told this several times, I would walk back to the machinist and say, I can't stand this project. It's going on for months. I'm done. I don't want anything else. Relax. You're almost there. You only climb, if you want to get to the top of Mount Everest, you don't look at the top. You take it one step at a time. And it sounds trite, but it's helped me out over the years. And then you get pressured to do things quickly. And his expression, let's see, where is it? Oh, there it is. There's no quick and dirty because people forget how quickly you did something for them. And then if it's dirty, that's what they see and that's what they remember. So let's see. Flash a couple other quick projects just to see. You can see that there are fun things that you can work on for people with disability. This is a windsurfing wheelchair. It was a student project that we helped on.
And
this is kind of a fun one. Do you recognize anybody? Have you shown this picture?
No.
Have you shown the device yet?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So you've seen the Ralph. This is the photographer from the Mercury News. So, and Jim's not as sinister as he looks there. He can put on that face. Any questions or suggestions? Not too much. Okay, I'll let Sandy come up.
Doug, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Up or down?
I'll
show you. A second.
Sure.
The center. Okay, I'm going to pass out. Stuff.
I can start with this one.
Am I?
Can you all hear me? Well, Doug talked to you about equipment, and I'm going to talk to you about people.
Oh, I got to introduce you. Wait. You can't go out of order. Sandy Bardas is a pharmacist at Stanford Hospital and Clinics with a clinical pharmacy specialty expertise in emergency, trauma, pain management, which we see a lot at Stanford, right? And investigational drug studies and anticoagulation theory. But more importantly, for the purpose of this talk, she's a member of Stanford's Administrative Panel on Human Subjects in Medical Research and the IRB Review Board number 3. So with that, take it away.
First, I'm going to answer a question that most people ask me, and that's, what's a clinical pharmacist? Most of you think of pharmacists as that person in Walgreens that you never see that makes the mistakes and stuff. But a clinical pharmacist is a medication manager, and I have always worked in clinical pharmacy, and what I do in clinical pharmacy is look at medications that each patient uses and make sure that they're appropriate for what is being treated, that the dose is correct, and that we monitor for any adverse effects, and most importantly, that we actually monitor that the medication is doing what it's supposed to be doing. In other words, that it's efficacious. Keeps me very busy in the emergency department because, contrary to popular belief, the average length of stay in the emergency department is only 6 hours. However, most people don't seem to believe that. So I go next. I just hit up. down. Why am I here talking about ethics? And I'm just going to do a brief history of the ethics of research. One of the first things going back in history was the smallpox vaccination back in the 1700s. The first human subject for smallpox vaccination was Dr. Jenner's son. So when we think about informed consent, I don't really think he had informed consent. I don't believe his father explained the risks of being the first person vaccinated against smallpox. Most of us think of the ethics of medical research in terms of World War II and the atrocities committed by the Nazis in human experimentation. The most famous, notorious name for this is Dr. Mengele. But there are, lest we just think that the U.S. government is guilt-free, there was a study called the Tuskegee Study, and what happened there was they took they say in the study Negro, but now that wouldn't be politically correct. And half of them were treated for syphilis, and half of them were specifically not treated just to see what the course of the disease was. And all of this put together has come up with some international rules on the ethics of research. And we'll go over the Belmont Report in the next slide, but the common rule is that if it involves a human subject, and if it's any systematic scientific review, it is research on human subjects. There are other regulations for research. The FDA controls both drugs and devices. HIPAA, which is your protected health information, which is a double-edged sword when you are doing research. And there are various state laws that govern research. The Belmont Report is kind of a Helsinki report. It was first published in 1979, and it kind of was a systematic review of the ethics of human subject research. And it consists of three principles, and all regulations generally go back to this Belmont Report. All of us who sit on IRB and those of you who will be actually doing protocols for IRB will, as part of your orientation, go over the Belmont Report. The three principles of the Belmont Report are respect for persons, and that we treat individuals autonomously and with respect. Beneficence, as we know in medicine, the first principle is to do no harm, to maximize benefits and minimize potential harm, and the justice. And justice refers to making sure there is a balance between the risk of the project and the benefit of the project. The other thing the Belmont Report deals with is if we have any vulnerable subjects. And this would be minors, which are defined as anybody under the age of 18. If we're doing research using prisoners as our population, and pregnant women. We also have to consider the intellectual and educational level of each subject. We might be doing something with somebody who might not have the vocabulary, the language skills to understand and be able to evaluate the risk and benefit. We'll have to look at, when we do a consent, learning style and how we present the consent process to them. What level of vocabulary do we use? What is their learning style? Do they need to see it? Do they need to hear it? Or do they need to do it? So we have to match the scientific validity with an ethics review. So here is our three principles of the Belmont Report. So in respect for persons, how do we fulfill that principle? We do that through informed consent. The consent must have full disclosure. It cannot be coerced. It must respect the person's privacy. And we have to consider maybe extra protections for those vulnerable subjects. I don't really know how to say this. Maybe it's beneficence. And that's where we deal with the risk and benefit of that. And then the enrollment process. How do we find subjects to participate in our research study? And we can't exploit anybody. Maybe we don't want to travel around and be much easier, for instance, to go to a juvenile detention center up in San Mateo, which was recently in the news. But we have to be careful on how we recruit subjects. And actually, that's a very important part of any research project that involves more than one subject. So what does the IRB do? That's an institutional review board. They review and approve all human subject research. And the IRB here at Stanford covers five entities: the university, the hospital and clinics, the Children's Hospital, the VA Hospital, and an independent educational foundation. So what is a human subject? Well, first of all, it's living, because a lot of work is done on cadavers. And whether we're going to do an intervention or interaction, essentially, if you talk to a living person, you're dealing with a human subject. And do they have an identifiable private information? Well, your name, age, sex, etc., are identifiable private information. And what is the definition of research? That's any systematic investigation to contribute to generalizable knowledge. You might be doing one small project, but if any part of this project is generalizable, then it is considered to be research. Did I skip one? An important thing that often people forget is sometimes they like to get started with their project and see if it's going to work. You know, kind of that thing, you know, is this going to work? Is this worth pursuing? But you cannot do that without IRB approval. You cannot recruit any subjects until the IRB has actually looked at your protocol. There are various panels on the IRB. Some of your panels might not actually include a human subject, and there are research panels for non-medical research. The whole process here is very helpful in deciding at what avenue you will be going through. The process of informed consent, and I think Doug did a really good explanation this, does not begin with the protocol and end with the signature, that you have to be in touch with your subject during the entire process. So what I would really like to do here is pretend we are sitting in an IRB panel and go over a generic consent form that was done for this class and talk about the different parts of consent. A lot of consent is boilerplate type of things, but some of it is individual. So the consent always starts with the title, telling what the name, your protocol title is, who your protocol director is, and the date of IRB approval. The maximum amount of time any protocol can be approved for is 1 year, and in some instances it is approved for less than 1 year, so you have to go back to the IRB to have your protocol renewed. So the first part is we check one of the following, whether you're an adult or a minor. And if you're a minor, there are actually two types of consents. One is a consent as if you were an adult, and that is read and signed and explained to if you're the parent or guardian of this minor. And another one is called an assent. This is for a child who's between the ages of 7 and 17. It's usually a one-page document that describes what's going to happen and essentially says it's only if you want to do this, if you feel that you're being hurt in any way, this is who you can talk to continue being in the research project. The next question that's usually asked is if you're participating in other research studies. Most protocols prevent you from participating in other research studies while you're on a protocol. What's the reason for this? That's because sometimes things are duplicated and it might be harmful. For instance, it wouldn't necessarily occur with a device, but let's say there was some you know. let's say there's some metal, rare earth metal, that you absolutely need to make this device work. And as part of the safety check for this protocol, you need to do blood tests. Well, if you're on another protocol, they might require blood tests too, and you might be having too much blood taken out of you for testing. So that's one reason why. The other thing is maybe there's a conflict between the two protocols, and we'll talk about that when we get to selection of subjects, meaning inclusion and exclusion criteria. You have to give a clear statement of the purpose of your research. It's not because I was curious. You must have a clear definition of purpose. And you must say what the criteria is to be a subject in this. For instance, whether or not, and some of the ones that Doug mentioned, is it a criteria that you must have a certain type of disability to be on the research protocol when he's developing a device? Obviously, for some of the types of devices being developed, you would want a certain type of disability or deficit in order to truly check the device out. We want to give the duration. Oh, I forgot to. All right, so in order to make this a little bit easier to comprehend, I decided to make up a device that you might be working on. This one's implantable to make it a little more risky, and it's to manage intractable hiccups, and I call it Banish the Belcher, because we definitely are looking down the road toward approaching a few venture capitalists to produce our device. So how would we select our subject? Well, first of all, they would have to have intractable hiccups. Maybe we'd put some exclusion criteria. For instance, if we knew the cause of the intractable hiccups, we might want to exclude them from it because we could treat the cause and cure their intractable hiccups from other ways. If this device is implantable, we'd like to give a sort of duration of study involvement. Usually, if we do something implantable, we're talking 2 to 5 years to estimate whether this is a workable device or not. What type of procedures are we going to do to test the device? One type of procedure that comes out of scientific method is blinding. And that would be that the subject would not know whether they actually have the device implanted in them or not, because we all know that the placebo effect cures about 30% of anything, regardless of whether we do something or not. So that's why we want to have a placebo-controlled trial, because if we're looking for efficacy, we've got to have more than 30% improvement. Otherwise, we can attribute that improvement to the placebo effect. Now, my little Banish the Belcher is going to be implanted. Now, how am I going to do this placebo? Because obviously this is going to need some sort of surgical intervention. So is it ethical to have a sham procedure? Be put under anesthesia, have a little incision made in your thorax, and say we implanted the device, but we didn't implant the device. Deception comes into this, but usually we think of deception when we think of psychological experiments, saying you're all going to go into this room, and of course Stanford is most famous for the deception experiment in terms of control, and you will all have equal chance in getting a prize, or you all have equal chance of being lord of the realm. Do you understand what a cohort is? A cohort is a way to step through a protocol so you can evaluate your success by exposing as few subjects as possible to evaluate it. Let's say you want to test the Banish the Belcher in 20 subjects, but after 3 subjects, you're going to stop enrolling subjects and evaluate the success of the protocol. Many drug studies are done by cohorts. For instance, if they're advancing the dose of the investigational drug to see whether or not, to see at what level you hit efficacy and at what level you hit serious adverse effects. All this should, of course, be disclosed to the subject. You have to name every possible risk, discomfort, and inconvenience. Physical ones, psychological ones. You know, do you want to be the one known as the person walking around with the Banish the Belcher implanted in you? Any social effects you might have and any financial implications that this would have? Potential benefits. How significant is the problem in relationship to the risk? I mean, is hiccuping so bad that you would risk general anesthesia to have a device implanted in you? The other thing in potential benefit is there must be a statement that this is not treatment. This is a research protocol. It must be revealed whether you will be a control or have the possibility of receiving a placebo. Let's say you're doing a Banish the Belcher. Two-thirds of the subjects will get the Banish the Belcher. One-third will serve as control. And the subject must accept the fact that they could be a control in the experiment. So actually, we depend on the altruism of a subject to participate in a research project because they may not receive any benefit whatsoever and maybe a few inconveniences. Yes?
So in the case of the sham, would you then say to all the subjects before it started that some of you are going to have surgery but we're not actually going to plan?
That's right. You must reveal that. And you must reveal what... You know, talk about Las Vegas. You must reveal the odds on being the sham.
Is that allowed in
the U.S.? Yes, it is. I put this in here because I actually worked on a protocol where we did do sham surgery. So this is most of the things that I'm talking about come from my experience. I just have to sanitize them for confidentiality reasons.
I worked on a project that they tried to do a study in Europe. They tried to make it blinded, medical device implant.
Mm-hmm.
They had to abandon the blinding because the only way to blind the patients was to not reveal the x-rays to them, and then that would violate.
And that's why some protocols don't get past IRB for exactly that purpose. And that's why the IRB would review a protocol and say, we don't think the risk or your study design keeps the subject benefit up front. So the subject has rights and alternatives. First of all, the subject must freely participate. There can be no coercion whatsoever. Because participating in a protocol restricts them from other therapeutic options. In the Banish the Belcher, suppose there's a medication that can stop them hiccuping. If they're going to be in your Banish the Belcher protocol, they're going to be prohibited from taking medication to stop their hiccups. Also, as Doug mentioned, this continuum of consent is also a continuum of the progress of research. The subject has a right to know that in their cohort, I was talking about the first three patients, two of them, the device worked great, but they had constant stomach pain from it. Every subject must be informed that there is the risk of having constant stomach pain if they have the device implanted in them. So there's a confidentiality and the use and disclosure of protected health information. That's what PHI is. We want to shield the subject from having anything personal about them being revealed. We want to abstract and sanitize this information as much as possible. We have to reveal in the consent who can actually see these records. The PI, sub-PIs, graduate students or undergraduate students working on the protocol, the FDA, the IRB. You have to list everybody, the venture capitalist, etc. If anybody is looking at these records, that must be revealed. There's a timeline of authorization. Usually this is some hideous amount of time, such as 50 years. The other thing is type font is very important. As you see, I'm up here looking over my reading glasses, looking at you. They must have thought of me when they had this, because it has to be in a large type font, so there's no question of not being able to read the fine print. There's financial considerations and conflict of interest. And I believe that was put up on the website, a very interesting article out of the New York Times about a spinal disc, an implantable device for back pain, one of the most common medical maladies in the United States, and how successful this is. Well, the physicians implanting this device had a very vested financial interest in making sure this device was successful. So there is a whole department, a subdepartment of Institutional Review Board that looks at conflict of interest. And it's not good enough that maybe Dr. B is implanting the device and he doesn't have any interest in the company, but his wife, Mrs. B, has a 50% share of the company. So they do look very closely at this conflict of interest and what financial ties they are. Having a commercial interest is not bad. It just has to be revealed to the subject that there is this there and what conflict of interest and to what degree the conflict of interest may influence the success of the protocol. Have to address withdrawal from the study, and there are two types of withdrawal. One is subject-initiated, and the other one is investigator-initiated. The subject can withdraw at any time for any stupid reason that they wish. There can be no reprisal for withdrawing from the study, no matter what reason they require. If they don't like the shirt you wear, if they feel you have body odor when you're working next to them, etc., it doesn't matter. There can be no reprisal, and there can, and they are no longer subject to the protocol, so if they want to go to your classmate because they think they have a better idea, they are allowed to do that. The investigator can also withdraw a subject from the protocol, and this would happen if the subject didn't show up for appointments or if they did something that puts them in the exclusion criteria. And the Banish the Belcher, they were secretly taking medication on the side to make sure that your little Banish the Belcher worked, or they wished to get rid of the hiccups. So there's all the legal responsibilities and disclosures that have to go into your consent. So the purpose of consent really is on safety and disclosure. You have to get the signatures, and the consents must be on file. The consent also may go through several amended versions as more and more information is learned about the protocol. So the proper consent must always be on file, and this is actually audited. Also, the person who is obtaining the consent must be conversant in the protocol. How will you be successful in doing a research protocol? Have a well-written protocol with realistic objectives. Although it is not the purpose of the IRB to rule on the scientific merit of your protocol, our emphasis is on the safety and of the subject. A realistic protocol does go a long way in being a safe protocol. You should have a detailed research design, because under the procedure section of the consent, you'll have to go through what the subject must do. There will be 6 visits with you. At these visits, these procedures will take place. List the resources you need for implementation of your protocol. Are you going to need to call in somebody from the outside? Be sure they're listed on the protocol. And make sure that the risk of research is commensurate with the benefit of the knowledge to be received. Now, I usually forget something, so let me just make sure. But I do. It is the first time you write a protocol and present it to the IRB is a very daunting experience. But it need not be. I think the process of presenting a protocol to the IRB helps you to clarify in your mind exactly what it is you're doing, and also get you up front to see what the risks are and the benefits to the subject. But remember, this is a research protocol. You will be relying on the altruism of the subject to participate. You are not treating the subject for any specific thing. So I believe I've gone a little bit over time. I'm fine. Are there any questions? Yeah.
The subject initiates withdrawal, but it's dangerous to the subject to
They can't, but you also have the option of explaining it to them. You have the option of saying, gee, it's not. We had, there are a couple of things, especially with implantable devices. I dealt with one protocol involving an implantable device that I raised in terms of disclosure, some of the very silly things that you would think of. This was a patient-controlled device, so there was sort of an electrical thing to it, and it happened just after 9/11 when increased airport security came through. And I asked the question whether going through the increased airport security might trigger the device and have it activate in a very inopportune time. And the first question I got back from the PI was that was a stupid question. Not a bright thing, by the way. for the PI to have done. But on second thought, they agreed that that should be part of the disclosure, that we had no idea. And another implantable device, one of the things in the consent is that the PI wanted the device back should they die. So I thought that was very amusing and say, oh, by the way, you know, just before you're cremated, I want my device back. Etc. So you can see the time length of this might be very long in participation because if at all possible, the subject is supposed to surrender the device back to them. So in order to answer your question, it's a process of consent. Signature is not the end of consent. If this should happen, some people might get discouraged. So you can talk to them again, and they might change their mind. One thing I should also go over is financial incentives on the part of subjects. Is let's say I'm looking for patients who hiccup a lot, and guess what? Nobody within the 10-mile radius of Stanford University has intractable hiccups. But there is somebody who lives in Gilroy. But they're on a fixed income or have a disability check or whatever, and it's expensive to come here and park your car if you have to pay for parking here. So as part of your research protocol, you're going to offer them $25 for every visit. Can you offer them a cruise in the Caribbean? No, because the reward for participating is not commensurate for the degree of inconvenience for participating in the study. So you can offer them a slight reward. Very common for students, it used to be male medical students, but a lot of psychology experiments will be advertised to the student community, is $20 or $30 to sit in the functional MRI for 2 hours. So that's commensurate with the amount of inconvenience. But very, very expensive enticements are generally frowned upon. Yeah?
Some IRB processes take over a year in certain hospitals and a matter of weeks or months in others. What's the difference between, is it the diligence of the PI that gets it through faster, or are there different processes?
Usually has to do with the exchange of questions and getting information on the protocol. I would say that when I receive a protocol, when I'm sitting at a meeting, we try to get the protocol approved within the 4-week time frame that it is. What stretches it out is if we're asking for more information or we need to call in some expert. Let's say in your implantable device, there's some heat generation in it. And we want to call in an expert to see how much heat human tissue can tolerate and how hot this gets, because we don't want to have a cooked piece of steak around the implantable device. So that would delay the approval of it because we felt we needed to call in some expert to talk about the device. So that's what usually lengthens it out. Another thing that lengthens it out is sorting out the conflict of any financial conflict of interest. But here at Stanford, if it's a straight, most protocols can be ruled upon within the 4-week period and not the year period it takes. It probably doesn't happen in your class, but a lot of protocols are multi-centered. Let's say you had a great idea, but there weren't enough subjects here, and you had a buddy, but he went to that engineering school in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and maybe he can get some subjects there, and you can get some subjects here. That would be a multi-center protocol. Two IRBs have to look at that protocol. So that engineering school in Cambridge would also have to get it. And sometimes we ask whether the protocol was approved at the other institution, and then each institution wonders whether they want to be the first to approve the protocol, because usually you want to be the second to approve the protocol. So that might another reason why it lengthens it out. But those usually happen more multi-center protocols. Are there any other questions? I want to also say that the IRB works very hard with investigators to get protocols through. I mean, the mission of Stanford is to do research. And the IRB should not be looked at as an obstacle to research. It should look at a way to help you refine your research so it goes smoothly and safely and successfully. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you.